Good morning. Disclosures are available at the registration desk. And for those joining us via the webcast, I'm Mike Rollins, telecom analyst here at Citi Research. I'd like to welcome back John Donovan, AT&T's Senior Executive Vice President of AT&T Technology and Operations. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike. The seat's still warm from the last guy.
Well, let's see if we can jump right into it then with some questions.
Before you jump into questions, I do have to reference the safe harbor statement we're putting up there. But in particular, I want to highlight that with Spectrum Auction 97 underway, I can't comment at all today about spectrum strategy or anything related to spectrum.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll get started with a high-level question.
That probably wouldn't stop you either, would it?
We'll see where the questions go.
Okay.
If you could give us, maybe just some high-level thoughts on what your operating priorities and strategic network initiatives are for AT&T in the coming year.
Yeah, so if you look at how those things tend to get measured into the capital programs, our capital program really is centered around reliability. And so for us, reliability spans all networks, means different things in different networks. For instance, in the wireless network, we've really clawed our way to right now having the premier LTE network in virtually every way that could be measured. And so our priority is to retain that reliability crown so that we are always with our customers the way that they measure reliability, the premier provider. So that's the top priority. The second priority really, is there's a number of things in. There's just the internal efficiency. What was our IT shop, marching it to the cloud, lowers our cost structure. And the wide area network, going to software-defined networking. We're investing in a lot of those things that are going to streamline and make us much more efficient and really start to bend the productivity curves that have been, good up to this point, but as we continue to scale, they need to get even better. And with this fiercely competitive environment, they need to get better still. Then the third area is really network and footprint expansion. I mean, every year, with the combination of electronics getting cheaper, labor methods getting better, we relook at the decisions we made about which technologies into which geographies, whether that's some white space in the wireless network in some rural areas, whether that's moving a portion of our footprint from ADSL to VDSL to upspeed them, or whether it's just upspeeding from 45 meg to 75 meg. We look at those cases every year, and then we put a bunch above the line to say, here's really good NPVs, good projects for us to do, and we do that stuff well. We're very good at building. So as the technologist, I know that a lot of folks, like to cut the capital views into how much is wireless and wireline and all those sorts of things. We really think about it in terms of reliability and capacity and customer experience. What do we need for efficiency, and then where do we go expand the footprint?
Maybe if we dive into the vision that you guys have laid out to become an all IP network, and I think you have some goals for 2020. If you can give us an update on how investors should think about that vision and the progress towards that?
Well, there's probably a couple different ways to think about it. I'll draw some parallels. If you look at the wireless business, we've announced we're going to sunset the 2G network in December 31st of 2016. And you'd say, well, why do you do that? You have customer displacements. First of all, As the number of customers that use 2G goes down, you move from a point where your variable cost comes out and you still have fixed cost. It costs money to power up that equipment to run the 2G network. And so you want to reduce the number of networks you're running. And that's frees up space, it frees up power, it frees up all the labor that it comes for the maintenance and those sorts of things. And so when you look at a IP network versus a TDM network, we really wanted to put a date out there that got people rallied around saying there is going to be an end of life in this network, and we're going to go to the new network, and how does one think about it? And so We are doing trials. The trials are proceeding right now in Florida and Alabama. And those trials are designed to say, how do customers react? As the old service is no longer becomes available. So we've been filing a lot with the FCC so they can keep a close eye on what we're doing as the regulator in the space. We've, you know, dealt with a lot of the objections that people have of saying, oh my God, you know, someone's ripping my phone out of the wall. You know, we've had to deal with making sure that the service is as good or better in all ways, that it's not just new and different and somehow compromising. So the trials are on track. I think internally we're getting our heads around the case. And customers, by the way, are migrating. So when you have an LTE network, the number of every customer that re-ups that was on 2G is not saying, how do I get a 2G phone? Now, some of them get attached to the clamshells that they like, and so you're going to have to pry them out of their hands in the end. But the natural thing is to go to the new network. So the customers every day are moving. And what's happening is the variable cost is coming out of the old networks, but the fixed cost is not. And so that's how, as an investor, I would think about it. The march to all IP networks allows us to be faster and more efficient, more flexible. If we go from 2G to 3G, my spectral efficiency is about 4X. When I go from 3G to 4G, that spectral efficiency is about 50% more efficient. But then I got a flat network behind it, so the cost per meg gets dramatically lower. So that's why we want to get them on the newer technology. We want to take advantage of more software, more Moore's Law, and just, better service flexibility.
Yeah, and just to clarify, the trials in, is it Alabama and Florida?
Yep.
Is that a wireline trial, which is different than this 2G wireless, or is that a wireless trial?
Yeah, I'm using 2G as an example because it's easy. Yeah. It's a wireline trial in those two things where we are on the path, because we have regulatory approval already, to retire our TDM service. And you will only have an IP product available. And so when you think about that, new questions arise, not like, hey, I need to connect up phone service to my new home, and you sell them the new one. It's about how do you retire the old one and have someone who's been with you for 40 years using the same handset, how do you manage through getting them onto the new platform? So it is a full cycle of retiring the wireline network that was the traditional copper-based TDM network.
So when I try to visualize the wireline network, you know, I visualize you start from the house and you have, you know, copper fiber that runs to a central office in a town, and then you aggregate that at a more regional level and you keep going up from there. When you go to an all IP network, what does it mean in terms of the way the topography looks, the way the labor looks, and in a sense, trying to, you know, for all of us in the room, you know, picture the type of savings that you could achieve by going into an all IP network?
Well, the simplest way to describe it is where you go from a world where everything is physical to where a world where anything can be virtual, which means that you can change your processes, you can reprice quickly, you can dispatch more efficiently, you have visibility into all of the assets. So everything that is traditionally viewed as the web in its evolution path and its speed and all those sorts of things, you can begin to do in your network. There still is the physical dimension that the wire is the wire, the fiber is the fiber. We're in that business. But when you start to move up the layers of the network where you start to actually create a service, you can sit down and you can launch a new service type extremely quickly. You don't have all the physical changes that are attached to every move that you want to make. And so those systems being dated are not really investable. And so they haven't become more flexible and they haven't evolved the way other software-based systems have.
So can you reduce the number, for example, of physical aggregation points?
Well, let me give you an example through the eyes of an enterprise customer. Last year, we trialed a router that we bought from one of the big router companies that's sole purpose in life was to aggregate wireless traffic in the metro area. We dropped a piece of software on that and said, now we want you to do transport Ethernet services for a business. and the software allowed it to now do that second function. So the number of access points that I have to do Ethernet service from can grow as a result of that from 50 to 500. So now all of a sudden, I'm suddenly, just by software, I'm closer to all my end customers. Those are the sorts of things that you can do. Now, from a customer standpoint, what's extraordinary in that is the customer can upspeed their network by themselves on the web. They can find the location, they can look at the service, and I don't need to be involved. I don't have sales friction, I don't have order friction, I don't have mistakes in a back office. I can get flow through. And so that's why IP is so critical. It's not so much that you get, you know, electrons on the wire flowing faster. It's that your processes can be transformed by software. So you can become more flexible, you can become faster, and dramatically more efficient.
So if we dive a little bit more into the wireless side and wireless capacity, you talked about the opportunities to move from 2G to 3G to 4G. I presume one of those enablers is voice over LTE. How is that progressing in terms of some of the launches that you've done, and where do you see that evolving over the next 12 months as an enabler of improving spectral efficiency?
Right. Well, I feel like we have an inherent advantage with our site density. So for us, VoLTE is big because not only does it use less spectrum for a voice call, and not only does it provide high-def voice, which is a feature that somewhat makes voice calling sexy again. When you get it, it's so dramatically compelling. Like the first call I did with my wife, she said, "There's something wrong with the phone." And I said, "Well, just keep talking. Maybe it'll go away." And she said, "No, it's actually weird. It's like you're sitting next to me." So I said, "Let's just keep talking." And so then she said, "No, this is actually weird. It actually feels like you're inside my head. It's so clear. It almost feels like a thought. It is that good." And so you have a feature. You have the efficiency of it. It's going to, I think, be compelling enough that it's in the next couple of years, as the handsets become capable and more of them, it's going to really create a compelling requirement for voice. Now, what happens is, when you put voice over LTE, you have to have the cell density, because all of a sudden a mistake on your data network is a dropped call. Right now, the speed might slow, the latency might pick up, your session may invisibly to you have disconnected and reconnected. All of a sudden, those things manifest as dropped calls. So for us, the voice over LTE has been a really a good march for us. We really are happy with the performance of the network, the drop call rates, the performance. And so we're methodically re-optimizing our network from LTE being about data and therefore about speed and latency to one that's about voice, which means we need to reconfigure and re-optimize everything to make sure that we have this net without these holes in it. Because in a data session in our network, when you didn't have LTE or when you hit a flat spot, you went from LTE to HSPA Plus, and almost every app you would be using doesn't know the difference between, 14 mega speed and 7 mega speed. But in the voice world, that's a drop call. So it's important for us, really important.
If we take a step back to the Project VIP initiative in aggregate, can you help the buy side, reconcile with a little bit more detail of the capital spending reduction going into 2015 to, I think the guidance now is, $18 billion. And what drove that very, significant level of savings relative to some of the initial anticipations of the program and, where investor expectations were prior to you, describing the new number?
Yeah, I think there were three things that allowed us to land that program more effectively than the original plan and get that camelback of capital spend, if you will, out of our capital program. And the first is that with a three-year horizon, when we did VIP, we had a three-year horizon, we had really good visibility into the factory sizing, if you will. So when you look at things like labor vendor communities that help you with, whether it's tower climbing crews or people that go into central offices. So you were able to, we were able to size our labor force, take a 3-year horizon, lock down the resources, and so we had a good runway with which to plan, and that was more efficient. The second thing is we did, I think, a very good job of making sure, to my earlier point, that it was much more of a software-driven upgrade. There were a lot of things that we did, whether it's upspeeding. So there was a construction component, but more of our internal processes were software-driven. So I think we tended to have our processes really dialed down. And the third thing is our cycle times. I mean, I think we have world-class cycle times. I don't think there's a carrier in the world who can deploy faster than us capacity. And so we got really good at that. And when the cycle times go down, you know, I build faster, there's less cash in the machine that's lubing it for, you know, to take the friction out. So I think those three things combined got us through faster. And throughout the VIP period, when you looked at how we were reporting our progress, we were consistently, you know, running slightly ahead of schedule, slightly ahead on a cost basis. And so last year we were able to, you know, kind of announce that with very few exceptions, like, you know, the number of businesses passed with fiber, there's some things where there's still work to complete, but for the most part, that program was checked off, and therefore, we were able to take that hump, if you will, of capital spend out. So I feel very good. Like, you know, I'm the person that should be most paranoid, right? If moving our capital spend down would make a person paranoid, I'd be it. But I feel like, you know, the capital that we've given guidance for next year is sufficient to cover the things I talked about, hold reliability, build all the capacity, do our internal efficiency march, and then where prudent and effective, do the footprint expansion.
One of the components of the VIP program, you were referencing earlier the help you're getting from a density of cell sites, and part of the program was to further densify cells and to add, whether it's, I think, DAS or small cells, leveraging fiber in buildings. You know, where are we on each of those? And it sounds like, you know, you were also mentioning that you have more work to do on the enterprise side. If you can, you know, share with us some thoughts there, that would be great.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we did when we did VIP that was really helpful is, you know, there's, at that point, we went into a wholly integrated planning process. So, you know, at our scale, you know, and you want to move quickly, if you franchise stuff and say, okay, in wireless we have these backhaul projects to do, in U-verse we have these neighborhood projects to do, and then we have these small cell projects to do. We went in and said, you know, let's just look at the infrastructure across all three, and can we use the same fiber that's to the cell site? Can we plan around it being serving businesses as well? Should we proactively wire that last 1,000 feet? And that's what we did. We did an integrated plan, which I think afforded us really good flexibility to move quickly. Now, to your question on the density, one of the things that has now manifested in thousands of cell sites of greater density than our competitors is during the time when the early days of the iPhone, when we weren't at capacity, we were doing extraordinary things. And so our designs were denser, our requirements were denser, and so we put a lot of time into venues and buildings back then. So if you look at the in-building systems, in-stadium systems, we have dramatically more assets deployed than our competitors. Now, some of those are network sharing arrangements, so we're there, they're there, but we have the owner's economics and they have the renter's economics in far greater proportion. So we were early, we were fast, we were aggressive, and now with a software-based capability and an integrated planning process, we're much more capable now of knowing incrementally how to most effectively go serve a building. And so now my marketing partners are actually starting to look at a much more localized approach. Historically, you know, most big companies would sell by account. So if the company's headquartered in Chicago, we'd go call on them in Chicago. They'd buy a 7th floor down in Dallas. Now what we're doing with these new tools is our sales reps can look on a tablet, see the assets that are deployed, walk in a building and knock on the door and say, hey, you know, you can materially upgrade your infrastructure. So the seventh floor in Dallas calls back in Chicago and says, you know, dude, I can get way better stuff in my building down here, so can I do an upgrade? And so it sort of almost fundamentally reshapes things, but you'll see an element of all of the things that we do investment and change-wise has that element of the software, like you can sell differently now. When you can give someone a tablet and allow them to pinch on a map and see what's in the building, that's very different than the old telco environment saying, I got to pick up the phone and I got to make a request to see what's in the building, and then I got to go into some system and look things up. So lots happening.
You're in a very interesting position, you know, in terms of you manage a large wireline network, you manage a national wireless network. AT&T is in a process to buy DirecTV, a satellite company. So you're making a lot of investment, whether it's year to year or in acquisitions, in access to homes, to people. What's the opportunity or risk, depending on which side of it you're looking on, that a third pipe emerges into the home? You know, right now you have, you know, the telephone company, the cable company, you have wireless and satellite overlaying it. How do you view a third pipe emerging for the home to do robust broadband services?
Yeah, well, I think that any threat that would come has to come over the air, because I think there's a natural impediment to redigging to the home. I mean, it's 80% labor. So there's not any magic to the labor side of getting into the home. So I think there's a natural upgrade cycle that occurs on that. And so at some point, you know, ADSL exhausted and customers bought VDSL. At some point, VDSL will expire and people will go fiber to the home. And then fiber will have electronics and do a gig. And then one day someone will figure out how to go from 1 gig to 10 gig. And the infrastructure and the apps kind of move along. But I think there's a natural impediment to a whole bunch of people, additional people, digging their way into the home or near the home just because it's a high upfront capital cost. If there's going to be a threat, it's going to be over the air, right? So as you notice today, there are very different wavelengths that can get into the home. The higher the wavelength, the better you can carry video, but the more power you need closer to there to penetrate the walls. And so whether it's, you know, if you look at Wi-Fi, you know, Wi-Fi is, if you look at the broadband pipe and say, well, the customer doesn't buy broadband anymore, maybe you could think about the broadband pipe as Wi-Fi backhaul. I mean, but eventually the physics are you get the packets in the ground as fast as you can because the math in the ground is better than the math in the air today. And, I mean, it really is a physics problem, if you will. And so the access part of it is changing and evolving as spectrums and technologies work together. But the real value, in my view, is getting it into the ground. And so if you look at a satellite network, for instance, a satellite's the most efficient way to deliver real-time video in a broadcast basis. But it's if you wanted to do on-demand, you'd be much better off pre-positioning content near their home and delivering it over the wire. And so more and more of our opportunity centers around integration. And I think we have to have a last-mile strategy that covers many last miles, and we have to make sure that we're doing the right things on the right spectrum with the right technology. But it's still about the ground-based network, which is where like a heck of a lot of electrons still move.
So you talk about both physics and economics. Is it an if or a when for wireless to create a competitive third pipe, whether it's, you know, regardless of the technology or the spectrum band?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the path of G's, we're at 4G, and you know, what's 5G look like? I mean, you can now start to see the technologies that produce the leapfrog in bits per hertz over the air. So you can kind of see 5G beginning to take shape. It's probably a decade out before It's there, but it's a big enough leapfrog that you can start to see it coalesce. So I think the trick is not some magic saying which technology. Those things are actually more obvious. The hardest thing as a technologist is to pick the window, because with Moore's Law, I can save 1.5% a month doing nothing. If I'm late, I get punished, right? So there's a penalty to be early and there's a penalty to be late. So picking the right timing is probably more important than, you know, dwelling on which technology will prevail, because I don't think there's, by the time you get to it, there's not a ton of debate about which technology.
If we talk a little bit about the two announced transactions that are pending, iUSAcell and DirecTV, how do we think about the investments and how you're going to look to create some form of scale through those acquisitions?
Well, there's a geographic contiguity with Mexico that, from a customer-facing perspective, provides opportunity. You know, as goods and people flow across its borders, you know, communication is a good supplement to that. So that side of it, you can kind of imagine what offers might look like. But from a network and technology perspective, we've got to get a cost structure that fits the market, but there's a lot of leverage for us in the back office. Again, getting back to how we're architected, that's cloud-based, nodally, this is really a pretty straightforward type of thing. In the case of Direct, I can't really talk much about it, but you know, hypothetically, if you start to look at delivering video across all screens, we're already a video delivery network. So, Mike, we've well crossed over 50% of our network is video. Any new network design we do for anything, wireless, wireline, no matter what it is, we start with a design around video. So we're a video delivery network. So hypothetically, if we were to look at satellite, you'd look at that asset, you'd say, how do we augment these things, and which network should deliver which content at which time to which screen? But I think having all of the assets provides you a lot of opportunity to ensure that you're doing exactly the most economical thing for every customer situation.
And just a quick follow-up on iUSAcell. Is there a clear path with iUSAcell's assets to deploy LTE?
Yes.
And maybe then taking a step back on the customer side, what kind of experience would a customer get in Mexico versus U.S. would be quite similar? Do you envision it being differently in some form?
Well, when I look at it from a network perspective, it sort of feels like the U.S. circa 2009 or 2010. Smartphone penetration down in the 20%, 29, 28, high 20s%. Network quality is kind of where things were back then. So for us, the playbook looks similar and familiar. So I see a lot of parallels and a lot of opportunity.
And I noticed recently that there's a new ad campaign about the strongest signal for AT&T. What should your customers expect from your service? And what kind of capabilities should they get today versus how that evolves over time?
Yeah. Well, depending on the application that you use, speed is sort of overplayed. They want it the same way when you buy cars. People want horsepower, and most people don't know that it's the torque that gives them the acceleration and all that kind of stuff. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to land on, with our denser cell site, the capability that we've got, that advantage, what's understandable to the customer. We looked at a bunch of different messages. Customers generally have learned that the number of bars is correlated to the performance, and so they're looking at it and saying, a strong signal, that's a good thing. There's a footprint dimension to it. There's a speed dimension to it. There's a reliability dimension to it. And it tested very well with our customers. And it's gotten noisy out there, about people saying that I have the fastest this, I have the most that, I have the biggest this. And then is it for the city? Is it in the suburbs? So it's gotten kind of confusing. We tried to land one that aligned with our advantage, that was sustainable.
What are you seeing in terms of don't know if you can give us more of a sense of specific data consumption levels or the direction of traffic in terms of, you know, how much data goes down to the user versus, you know, back up to the network.
So if you look at a modern architecture, anything that's new is basically done with mobile cloud. That's the architecture. It's the only relevant architecture in the future. Now, that's a bold way to say something because it's going to be a decade march. But everything that, for instance, we do as a company, not as a supplier of communication and services, but as a company, everything we design is designed that way. So our technicians today carry tablets, and what those tablets allow them to do is our best technician and our average technician converge because the network does a set of diagnostics, and the protocol delivered to the tablet is a protocol that was built by our best tech. So it's a smart system that did a whole bunch of lookups, and that tech doesn't know that it's different today than it was yesterday, and they don't know that it was built by the best tech in the field. They just have the protocol there. And so when you look at those kinds of capabilities, every business is marching down that path. And so now when you look, you just say, well, if that's the case, what are some of the consumption and trend changes? There will always be something, the video stuff, we don't know which. I just read this morning that Facebook crossed past YouTube for the most video viewing. And for those who look at videos on YouTube, it has the autoplay feature now. When you stop on it, it doesn't autoplay. That materially impacted our wireless network. Now you'd say, well, do we have to tell you that that's going to occur? No. What we're world-class at is figuring out what the growth curve looks like, but which is the thing that arrives on which date to cause it to happen? There's only so many hours in a day. We know you're going to spend so much of it on video, whether the video is long form, short form, whether it's YouTube or Facebook. And so we kind of watch those growth curves. We look at the big trends. The big trends are video is exploding in both consumer and in enterprise. Enterprises are using it for things like org announcements. You know, you used to put them in an email and you read it. Now everything has a video, and you know, and so that trend is there. The second thing is that there's a proliferation of devices that comes from most people carrying multiple devices, particularly if they're in the enterprise space. So all of those trends, I think we've got a good handle on. Here's the things I'll tell you, that the actual growth of time is leveling because there's no more hours being made in a day and most people are glued to their mobile device. Browsing is going down because most of the things we go to browse for are becoming apps, and the apps are starting to fragment browsing a bit. The app usage is starting to stabilize. People download lots, use very few. They use those very few very consistently. Those patterns are starting to stabilize. So really, for the first time for us, we're starting to see demand stabilization where there's less spikes and more of the big trends are driving the network demands. And so, you know, when we say, well, we're going to model in growth in our network next year of 48%, we're darn good at that. And we always act surprised when something pops on the scene. But when it goes up, something else tends to be going down. So those trends are, I think, starting to look like curves and not like surprises.
And so with the more video that you were describing, does that just automatically denote that there's going to be more down than up in the network?
No, I wouldn't say so, because the user-generated portion goes up, and social has the counter trend to that. So when we think of video, we think in terms of viewing as opposed to production. But and the Dallas Super Bowl, I guess it was 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. But at the Dallas Super Bowl, that was the first event where we had more bits leave the stadium than enter the stadium. And that was seminal. Now all of a sudden, that's happening at all of the big events. the World Series, and so on and so forth. And so you look at those, and then it works its way down into the more you know, standard sorts of demand curves, if you will. So I think we're seeing that video on one end, but I want to contrast for you, Mike. The Internet of Things is the polar opposite of video. Video is fat, sticky bits, set up a session, stream. The Internet of Things is chatty, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And so it's really an interesting problem for network people to deal with, one that's control plane intensive and one that's data plane intensive. And we've never really had both hit us simultaneously. So it's an interesting problem for us.
We have mics roaming around the room if there are any questions from the audience. You know, one question that comes up is how you look at Wi-Fi as a competitor that could, whether it's take traffic or users away from you from a mobile broadband perspective, or do you see it more as a complement and enabler for mobile broadband?
Well, we were early in. You remember we did a couple of acquisitions, Wi-Fi companies. We were trying to offload traffic from our network in the early days of the iPhone. We embraced auto authentication, you know, and the number of sessions that we had a Wi-Fi on our own Wi-Fi was exploding. So we view it as a complementary network and always have. We think it's, you know, great. We want to move it that way. I just saw that, you know, a study over in Europe. Europe has obviously different economics around Wi-Fi and those sorts of things. They had roughly 83% of all of their mobile data usage was over Wi-Fi. And so that trend is already there. It's just been more for data, but now voice over Wi-Fi is starting to come in. But I think it really just centers around, I'm going to use the best network. Best is defined as the cheapest that works effectively for me, whether it's, you know, Wi-Fi or millimeter wave or satellite or whatever. That's really the value proposition. We have to say, what's the customer requesting to do? Which network do they belong on for that? And the one they belong on is the one that gives them the experience and the cost economic profile, if you will, for both us and them that makes the most sense. And that's why I think the breadth of assets is really important, because there's not going to be one home run that you hit.
Here, please.
Hi, two questions. One on the 2G spectrum. Now that you put a date out there for end-of-lifing that, are you pre-positioning assets there for refarming ahead of that date? And how quickly do you see yourself being able to refarm the 2G spectrum? And then secondly, on your all-IP transition, should we think about it as a steady sort of ongoing improvement in margins in both the wireline and wireless businesses? Or are there certain years there'll be more step function jumps as you do more significant cutovers and capabilities and things? Is it so more gradual, or are we going to see step functions in certain years as you look out ahead?
Yep. On the first question, we've been farming 2G spectrum. If you look at it, most of the markets we have out there are either 5 or 10 megahertz of spectrum that we have. That's the 5 megahertz is the lowest we can keep in play and keep the network productive. So depending on the market, we either have 5 or 10 megahertz. And there are very few markets where we aren't already down to the minimum. So when we do the 2G network shutdown, we'll repurpose that spectrum very quickly. There's some markets where that's at 850, some of them are at 1900, but we have been farming them over the last 5 years. From 2G to 3G, we went from 25 megahertz to 15 to 10 to 5. So we're down at minimalist for having the quality that we need. On the second question, I think there'll be a smooth curve on the IP transition. Underneath our numbers on the wireline enterprise side of the business, there's a very significant migration underway of customers from copper-based to fiber-based services, from TDM to IP, in their case, from data centers to cloud-based services. So we're starting to see very, very heavy migrations to IP underneath our numbers, and we've been working very hard to try to manage the hump of cost that comes when you have, you know, mixed networks. And so we're getting to points now where we feel very comfortable that we'll continue to manage it smoothly from a financial perspective. So I don't expect any sudden surprises, because we've had a bunch of that migration work undergoing for the last 24 months. Last 12 months, it's accelerated dramatically. And frankly, since 2008, I think a lot of enterprise CIOs have decided that the risk-reward ratio is tipping more in favor of moving to IP. So we've seen an acceleration of that. And that for us is good news. A cloud strategy requires fat pipes. We're starting to see a lot of customers speed up, and I think we've done a very good job with our cloud strategy of maintaining the value in a managed network and not selling transport only, that we're really selling virtual private networks.
That brings us to our time today. John, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us this morning.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you very much.